The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Going to be fascinating, fun, informative, and in some cases probably quite unforgettable for many of us, as is usually the case when William Tompkins stops by for a conversation and a little sit-down chat. We're going to go 3 hours tonight with Bill, and if you've heard before Mr. Tompkins, you'll understand that that's no problem at all. He has a mind that is like literally an encyclopedia of his life and then some. Joining us as well tonight, Frank Chile, and we hope to connect with George Filer in a little bit. Frank, are you there?
I'm here. Good evening, Jeff.
Thanks for being here as well. Where are we with the Bill Tompkins story? I mean, this man clearly is a walking library. His vast knowledge and his experiences are enormous.
Jeff, every time I speak to him, and it's always an honor and a privilege to speak with him, he shows me other aspects of his experiences that I've given no consideration to until we've begun discussing them.
Wow.
And he opens up all kinds of other doors of knowledge.
Yeah. Bill Tompkins is 93, for you folks out there who count such things. It means nothing to me. However, in this case, it will give you an idea of the extraordinary material that this man is made of. He is every bit as sharp now as he has ever been. He has a book out, and we'll talk about that later. There'll be several other books coming. But as Frank mentions, every time we sit down to talk, I get just carried away in different directions. The stories are just endless, they're fascinating, and they're just not to be denied. Frank, thank you again for putting this together. Let's go over and say hello to Bill. You there, Bill?
Okay. I'm here, Jeff, and I'm raring to go.
Good. Now, you're living in Southern California somewhere. We won't go any further than that. But the weather has been high. It's in the 90s again up here. I'm in further north in California a little bit. And it's hot everywhere. This is being called climate change by some. I call it human weather manipulation and engineering, perhaps out of control, perhaps not, I don't know. But the hand of man is clearly laying across the face of the planet, and it's climate. Would you agree or disagree with that?
I'd have to agree, but I have to ask you, why did you go do that, Jeff?
What did I do?
Why did you go set up this climate the way you did?
Oh, see. Well, we should have talked before. I'm sorry. I tried. I didn't get it right, but I tried. Anyway, we'll see what we can do here in about a month Although in a month, that's August, and August is supposed to be the hottest month. Well, I don't know.
Skip, I believe George is with us now.
All right. Major Filer, are you there, sir?
Yes, I'm here.
Where you been?
In hot New Jersey.
It's hot there, too. What is it today there in New Jersey? What was your temperature today?
I got like around 90.
Yeah. We were in the mid-90s here, and it's going to over 100 tomorrow or the next day. And George Filer, Major Filer, of course, the editor of Filer's Files, the world's most prestigious and wonderful weekly UFO ET historical free email that you can get. It's a magazine, basically, an electronic magazine, Filer's Files. Now, George lives in Medford, New Jersey. I'm in, essentially, Medford, Oregon, M-E-D-F-O-R-D, Medford. And much of what we've been talking about with Mr. Bill Tompkins has taken place in Medford, Oregon. I mean, the links and strange connections, in fact, the connectivity of all of the material we've gotten from Bill Tompkins is extraordinary. So it's in the 90s here today. It's in the 90s back there with you, George. What do you think so far about all the things that we've heard from Bill?
Well, it's absolutely amazing what he's told us, that it's all been kept pretty silent up till now. There's little bits and pieces that I was aware of
sure.
through other Navy friends and so on, but it's all starting to fit together with the information he's providing. And Dr. Bob Woods, who's a good friend of mine, told me to listen to him, and I'm listening because I think he has some excellent information for the rest of us.
It's phenomenal information. Whether you accept it or not, all of you listening, it's certainly up to you, but leave the door open. Take a look around. Frank, what is the reaction you're getting from your folks? You've got a big circle of people.
Jeff, the consensus is they want to hear more. They want to hear greater detail. They want more revelations and are hoping that more people will be nudged by Bill's commentary to come forward and divulge their part behind the scenes and make that public and part of the public record.
No, I agree with that. That's what we're doing here. All right, let's turn Frank and George down for a bit, and we'll concentrate on Mr. T. I saw pictures, Bill, by the way, of the we mentioned that you had lived in Medford, Oregon, and worked with the Navy League up here, and you designed and built two homes up here, and I got to see pictures of those. I hope to drive by them at some point.
Excellent. They may not look quite as good as they did when they were new, and then whoever it was that purchased them may have modified them.
Yeah.
But the architecture was kind of fun.
Oh, I'll bet for you. The design mastery that you are must have been a real kick in the pants. I built several homes myself, and that's quite a challenge. It is said that when you start out to build a home, if you end up with 75% of what you want, you're lucky. I suspect in your case, you know exactly what I'm talking about. All right,
yes.
My friend. Medford, Oregon, the Navy League. During the war, Bill Tompkins, as many of you know, if you've listened before, and if you haven't, all the programs are on the right side of Rents.com for you. Bill, during the war, was at the highest levels of secret U.S. naval operations. Among other things, Bill was a participant in the debriefing of spies that we had sent over to Germany and were rotated in and out of Germany during the war, and they would bring back with them information and sometimes apparently pictures, photographs. And some of the information was so astonishing that Admiral Bada, who was in charge of this, was, I guess, unbelieving. He couldn't believe what he was hearing. And I want to talk just a little bit about those men who went over there and were spies during the war, and how it was that when you were listening to them, how you processed some of the stuff you're hearing. German flying discs, stargates, other planets, reptilian ETs. This isn't 1942, 43. This is the war. How did that strike you, Bill?
Well, actually, Jeff, this was a situation where you had these young Navy operatives. Most of them were full lieutenants. A couple of them were JGs. But these fellas were actually separate from regular Navy intelligence. They had one mission, and that was to get into Germany and the occupied areas and find out what in the world the situation was, where it looked like the Dracos and the Exeter and the other
reptilians,
extraterrestrials,
yeah.
Reptilians and also other extraterrestrials,
mm-hmm.
were involving the Third Reich and the SS on extraterrestrial vehicles, weapons that were unbelievable from space, and what was the intention of the extraterrestrials to give this information to Germany?
Right.
And so you have to go back to what it was that they found out going into different areas, different underground facilities, different test areas where UFOs had been essentially given to the SS and then asked to be put into production. So there was what they called the 17 different vehicles. The Dracos gave Germany roughly 17 different types of spacecraft carrier battle group ships.
Wow. Now this is so the Germans could go into production on them, because German technology was extraordinary and they could build almost anything. 17 different types. Some we've seen photographs of. They look like long tubular craft. Some were discs. Some were extraordinary in their configuration. I have also in Bill's section, you'll find a link there right below that, somewhere down in there, of World War II German disc technology. It's actually in a special feature box down below Clark McClelland, I believe. There are four stories there, four different ones, and they're fully illustrated. And there is actually some video of what appears to be one flying German saucer, if you will. A quick question about these Navy lieutenants and JGs. They had to have come from German-American families. They had to be extremely fluent in German or they would never pass over there. Correct?
Absolutely. And they could even copy the various dialects even in the occupied countries.
Wow.
Now, these fellows were unbelievably capable. And yes, they all came from German families. But that they had a dedication to Admiral Ichabod that is unbelievable. And they knew that the information they were bringing back was not only unacceptable, but you have to look at when this information was presented. They had some documentation. They had some notes that they wrote. Some cases, they had poor photographs. And the rest is verbal information from their notes about what they had spent the last 4, 5, or 6 months studying.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Okay? And so these fellas then picked up some of the part of the information that turned out to be correct later on,
mm-hmm.
maybe even a year and a half later, that the actual mission was with a joint operation of the German Space Navy, which was to be built of these some 17 different types of extraterrestrial mm-hmm. vehicles, spacecraft carriers, destroyers, fighters, reconnaissance vehicles, all spacecraft. And that these operatives then were put together a different agenda for what Germany was really doing. And I don't want to make this complicated, but there was a young lady that was contacted actually before the Dracos contacted the SS and started giving Germany information and then vehicles, extraterrestrial vehicles that they had and were operating. This other young lady actually was also contacted by different extraterrestrials. It's pretty well believed that they were called the Nordics.
And now, this is Maria Orsic, right?
Maria Orsic, okay. Mm-hmm. Now, this is a very pretty girl. You have to see pictures of her.
Well, I have pictures up in that special video I've put together. It's actually just stills for the most part. But there are several pictures of Ms. Orsic, and she's a stunning-looking woman. She looks like what we would think of as an E.T., tall, blonde, or a Nordic. I mean, she's one of those women who's blessed with perfect bone structure, facial features, poise, and obviously was a stunning person.
Okay, that's a good description. Now, what you have to do is back off here and listen to what we're going to say that the Nordics said to her.
Right.
First of all, they started telling her about themselves. Then they got into what they thought she should be doing. And I'm putting it that way because that's actually what took place.
Mm-hmm.
She should be listening to what they had to say. And then over a period of time with additional people helping, design and build a very large space transport. Put all of her family, all her friends, all her business associates, which later turned out to be 403 different people that were helping her design and build these vehicles. And they then were to get on board, leave the planet, leave the solar system and go to another star's planet out in the galaxy, which was a utopian planet, and live there permanently. Now, I know this sounds insane, but this is actually what took place. Now, while she was, and they were doing this, the Dracos and the Reptilians contacted the Third Reich, and in parallel to this operation, set up another program to review actual vehicles, brand shiny, bright new UFOs, okay?
Uh-huh.
17 different classes. So Germany was not given a document and some training of how to build it, build them. They were actually given vehicles, and brand new ones. They were shown how to fly them. They're kind of hard to fly. Some of them were easier, but most of them were difficult.
You're hearing all this from the operatives, or are you getting some of this from other sources, Bill?
Most of this is from the operatives, and it's over a period of 4 years.
Uh-huh. Now, these first meetings, excuse me, were with the Dracos and Reptilians obviously took place in the 30s. Maria Orsic was contacted in the 30s before the war, yes?
That's correct, yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the SS found out about the young ladies and all of her friends building these vehicles. Mm-hmm. Actually, they built two small UFOs first to learn how to do it. They then confiscated everything that she and her friends were doing and essentially took everything that they had and started to add that to the information that they got from the reptilians.
Mm-hmm.
And in a very short time, now I've heard several different time periods, but certainly less than 6 months later, probably earlier, they then turned around and the Third Reich told them, Murray and Oliver's assistants,
mm-hmm.
told them, you guys go ahead and do this yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You've got other people. You go ahead and operate independently. Now, she and they did not want to have anything to do with the military. They didn't want to help the military. They didn't want to have anything to do with it, but they had everything taken away from them.
Yeah, they didn't want... They weren't
given back to them.
I gotcha. They weren't party members. They were independent of the National Socialist Movement. In fact, only 1 out of 10 members in the German military were actually party members. Few people know that. This is fascinating. We've touched on it a little bit in the past, but I want to ask about these operatives one more time. What they reported about Maria Orsic has to include a very talented and skilled engineering and design and construction contingent of highly qualified and capable people to build these things. I mean, Maria didn't go out there with a saw and a hammer and some nails and put these together. These are very advanced machines. So who are the people that were working with Maria Orsic as far as the operatives were concerned? Did you ever hear anything about that? Who were her staff members?
Absolutely. That's in several pages of that book, selected by extraterrestrials. The 1,443
mm-hmm.
people that were then involved, including Maria, were some of those were scientists. Some of them were engineers. Many of them were technicians. Many of them were in medical research.
Uh-huh.
And so that group of people, yes, there were some of the fellows. There was a shoe salesman in Berlin, and there were farmers out in the field who actually, strangely enough, hawked their whole farm, got a loan on it so they could get the money to buy the materials they need to try to build these vehicles.
You can't do it without a shoe salesman, Bill. You know that, don't you?
I know that, yes. But the thing is that these operatives then were picking up information, some of which the next time or 3 or 4 times later of their mission back to Germany,
yeah, no break
the
time.
Occupied, mm-hmm. they would find a different version of the information that they had submitted several months earlier.
Ah.
So not everything, wait a minute, not everything was smooth. It's not misinformation, it's just that they found out and discovered more mm-hmm. about that particular subject. They made an emergency run back to San Diego to try to update the information that they may have submitted to the Admiral 6 months earlier.
So the sequencing was not textbook smooth. It came in fits and starts, and things
yeah,
were...
And you can't blame these fellows because they were unbelievable, Jeff, in what they brought back. And yes, it was very difficult for us, and particularly the Admiral, to accept much of this, and you have to stop and think. Even Germany, the high technicals in Germany, did not know the mathematics that were being used by the extraterrestrials, which could have been 10,000 years old, that mm. they've been using out in the galaxy.
Mm.
And astronomy. We had no real idea of astronomy. That was in the medical systems,
mm-hmm.
We're just June grads as far as what was really presented to us. And so the information that these operatives kept bringing back, which was fantastic information, that you were now dealing with some groups of extraterrestrials out in the galaxy that we've never met before, that we have no knowledge of, We don't know their mathematics. We don't know even the documentations that were brought back. Some were in German. And we, of course, I had a group of ladies that were typing these packages together.
Mm-hmm.
And so for a while, we tried to interpret the German to English. And then finally, we quit doing that. And if you, Lockheed, got a proposal or a package that we put together, and then I delivered to Lockheed,
mm-hmm.
Lockheed then was stuck with having to convert English to German. But that's not so bad. But some of the documents were in hieroglyphics. And I don't think people realize this.
This is fascinating because the Die Glocke, the so-called Nazi bell, which crashed in Kecksburg, was an advanced version, apparently, of the one originally built in Germany in the early war years and tested, and which may have been one of the two systems of propulsion for these flying discs and other flying craft that the Germans were building during the war. And we do have pictures of these. And I mentioned the Kecksburg crash because Clark McClelland was flown there by Dr. Kurt Debus instantly as soon as this object landed in Kecksburg. It was a controlled landing. He went up there with another German scientist, as you know. They were able to look at the object. Clark went up to it, pounded on it to see if there was anyone in there. There was no response. And there were strange hieroglyphics around the base of it. It looked like an acorn. And you can find this again if you look under Die Glocke on the right side. I've got a special feature on that under Clark McClelland, and you'll see the object. We have an actual color photo of it on a lowboy truck, and no one could figure out what these hieroglyphics were. Now you've mentioned hieroglyphics were being brought back by some of these incredibly brave young men who somehow got in there and got into the deeper layers of it all and brought them back. Now, maybe these hieroglyphics that Clark couldn't understand, and he certainly saw them, were from those earlier days, from the extraterrestrials who were working with the Germans.
Now, you're absolutely right. And actually, that vehicle crashed in the United States. That was not something that was in Europe.
Right.
And so that was right here, and you mentioned that the good doctor, Debus, went up there himself.
Well, he didn't. He sent what Clark reported, and maybe I misspoke, but he sent Clark McClelland and another German scientist, which might have been Heinz Kammler, up there, because Kammler would have worked on Die Glocke in Germany, and he would want, Debus would want Kammler to look at it. And I'm going to find out from Clark when we get together next who that other scientist was. So they went up, and the word that Clark gave was that this was a Die Glocke, an advanced version. This is, we're talking 20 years after the war, that landed in Kecksburg. It was Soviet built by German scientists. Remember, we didn't get all the German scientists. We got about 40% to 50% at the most. The Soviets got the rest. And this craft allegedly was out of control and came down in Kecksburg. It wasn't supposed to. And that's why Debus sent them. He said, get up there immediately, Clark, and we assume it was Kammler, but we're guessing. Whoever the German scientist was, it came over here with Debus and Paperclip. Get up there and look at this thing and come back and report to me. So this would have been a 20-year evolutionary jump in that style of propulsion unit, the Die Glocke, the clock or the bell, not the clock, the bell. Okay, excuse me, I just wanted to lay that out, make sure it was clear. It wasn't Debus that went there.
Okay, thank you. I think that this, the situation where the operatives brought back information, documents, in some small cases, some hardware, okay?
Oh, they did. Interesting.
But what the United States had to do is essentially all of these different research, medical and aerospace,
mm-hmm.
these fellows had to take that information and try to figure out what it was, including some of the hieroglyphics. Now, I want to make a little side point here that hasn't been touched.
Hold me. May I ask you to hold? I got to clarify something for our audience. Dr. Kurt Debus was an absolute genius. He was the director of operations at Peenemünde. He came over here after the war and ended up being the director of NASA from the early 1960s until, I believe, 1972, when he retired. He was, along with his German scientist compatriots who came over here under Operation Paperclip, he was NASA. He was our space program. Please go ahead with your sidebar.
Right. This is strange. Years ago, when we were living in Hollywood with my family, my mom and dad and my brother, my uncle Hardin lived in Santa Monica, and he was chief surgeon at the Santa Monica Hospital. Now, in the front part of the book, the one that we just released,
yes,
is a photograph of Uncle Harding on one of the camels over in Egypt and his wife, my aunt.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you don't see there is that this fellow spent every nickel that he could get a hold of for years bringing back or going over to the pyramids, going in them, and acquiring, without maybe the best legal arrangements, and paying people to bring, get out of the country with some artifacts. So
right.
Our living room, or his living room, in this big house in Santa Monica, has not only all kinds of artifacts, but he has hundreds of photographs, much of which are of artifacts. And his primary thrust was to decipher the Egyptian artifacts, which turned out to be very similar to extraterrestrial language.
The hieroglyphics.
Wow.
Uh-huh, yeah. Wow.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
So I was exposed to that when I was just a boy.
Well, this is fascinating because it is said, of course, by many that the Egyptians, as we know them now, didn't build those incredible structures. They had help, and the help came from off-planet. We were visited, called the Nephilim, whatever you want to call them. They were here, and they directed. The modern, or relatively modern Egyptians, not the Egyptians of 4,000 years ago, inherited these incredible pyramids and other relics, which were built with the help of extraterrestrials, which, of course, would argue for the validity of the hieroglyphics on Diglaca and other information that your operatives were bringing back from Germany. These were some very brave men. Wow.
Amazing, really, they were. So the mission that they finally kept changing, and because they got into talking to people, they talked to engineers, they talked to technicians, they talked to hundreds and hundreds of people, and this is not an easy job, because obviously that's what the Germans are looking for, American operatives, spies. And so they don't have an easy life. But information that they originally had, sometimes it was absolute, just exactly what they had presented to be. But more than 50% of it, part of it was incorrect. And so then packages that we put together and then were delivered to, say, the Naval Air Development Center in Warminster, Pennsylvania, a big, very big, large Navy facility. I went back there 7 times, and sometimes it was with additional information on new programs, but most of the time it was corrective information from what we originally had. Now, you can't blame these operatives. They were doing the best they possibly could and trying to get the information back as soon as they could. So there was updates on virtually every place that we contacted in research in the United States. There were additional information that went back, new packages went back, and then as they developed, they wanted us to give them additional information, and then we have different laboratories work together on the same program that the operatives brought back. So it's a tremendously complicated effort that these fellows were doing there.
Some of the operatives probably, I'm guessing, probably didn't come back. That's too damn dangerous. How they got into those positions, I don't want to spend much time on right now, but obviously they had some connections. There may have been Confederates working in the German programs that were working with the Americans that allowed these agents to gain access to positions from which they could gather the material they brought back here. They had to have somebody on the other side helping them get in, wouldn't they, Bill?
Absolutely, yes. They had dozens of people that were helping. And there were many women which were actually working in some of the production facilities that were not slaves, but were like lead women.
Mm-hmm.
That were then involved in the production of these different classes and different products that had to go into the extraterrestrial vehicles.
Well, absolutely. And look what happened in America. Who built most of our bombers and fighter planes? Women. American women. So, absolutely. Women are more than capable than men in many areas. And so you just put, again, 1 + 1 = 2. They had full measure of support. I have another question. You mentioned issues of health. I'm guessing that the extraterrestrials were interacting with the Germans regarding health. Now, that might or might not connect and tie into the fact that Adolf Hitler was the first person to promote and recommend vegetarianism for all the German people, that they stopped smoking, and the German war on cancer was the first in the world. People don't know these things. And I'm wondering if there might have been some connectivity between those health programs and projects and then the word, as it was, from the extraterrestrials.
Okay. Actually, Maria and her helpers got it first. So before the SS got it from the Dracos, she and her helpers were instructed not to smoke, just all of the things you're saying and many, many more.
Fascinating.
And that it's interesting that more of that actually came from the Nordics to Maria's group and went to the SS. But even with that being less, Germany made 180s on meat. Absolutely, they almost dropped it completely. And we're just now getting to the point that we here in the United States are sort of slowing down on it.
I have always said we will never advance as a species on this planet left to our own devices until and unless we stop killing and eating animals.
Yes, absolutely. No question. It's so much healthier not do that. I don't think people realize it.
Stop meat and dairy and add 20, 25 years to your life easily.
Yes, sir. Like, we almost never ate meat in our family.
Mm-hmm.
And that certainly had to help me live a little bit longer. I didn't smoke. I didn't drink.
Mm-hmm.
And these are very simple things to say, But so many people don't seem to understand why live 40 years or 50 years when you can live 80 years.
Absolutely, and they're not allowed to understand it, as we know, unfortunately. But I just wanted to bring that out as another sidelight to all we hear about is evil Germany, evil Nazis. These people were very intelligent people, and the first war on cancer, the first war on smoking, the concept that vegetarianism was the only way to go. Hitler was a vegetarian. So this came from somewhere. It just didn't just happen. And when you said that about health and the Dracos and the Nordics and the reptilians, I'm wondering if there was a connection there, and it seems like there may well have been. So
there absolutely was. And the one of the fellows, he was sort of prominent because he seemed to come back more frequently. But he brought your subject up several times and arguing with the Admiral in a normal, a nice way.
Yeah.
And they got into a debate on this. And the Admiral didn't agree with him. And 2 years, 3 years later, the Admiral made a 180. And I thought that was, that was such a nice thing for this fellow to say, and for the Admiral, of course, to disagree. And you go do your thing, I'm doing mine. And then later on, he backed off. And I thought that was such a nice thing for that operative to do with all of the problems and everything that he had to do over there. So hard to live.
Wow, what a fascinating little tidbit. That's remarkable. Just remarkable. Everything you tell us is remarkable, Bill. You have to keep talking for at least another 20, 30 years. We've got to get this out as much as we can.
Certainly you want to. I'm ready to sign up for extended life.
Well, I think you're already there.
Subject.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's another subject. But actually, the Germans... Well, Maria's group was working on it again before Germany was.
Uh-huh.
And, but extended life didn't come up from here. It came right from Europe. Okay?
Right.
And, the Nordic types that were influencing, Maria and her people, were constantly making a recommendations and suggestions medically, and that was part of their program. And in many ways, it got into the Third Reich too. And you just mentioned the fact that they made the 180 on the meat, they made the 180 on the cigarettes.
Yeah.
Why we should be doing that here? And for the operatives to bring that type of stuff back, I just think it's wonderful.
Well, I'm glad we got to talk about it and to tie that into the conversation, the narrative, because it is so important, and I've never been able to figure it out. Now it makes perfect sense. So there's always an explanation for things if you can just find the right people like you who can put it all together. Now, did any of the operatives, otherwise known as spies, remember from German-American families, spoke fluent German, and Bill has said that they could even master the local dialect of German, depending upon where they were in occupied Europe. They came back. Did they ever report to you that they saw our ET visitors working with German scientists? Did they see ETs? Did they ever tell you, Admiral, I saw an extraterrestrial. I saw a reptilian. I saw a Nordic. Did they ever say anything like that?
Okay, I'm going to try to explain something here, and I don't want to make it complicated. It is a little bit. There were extraterrestrial technicians who actually helped not just in engineering of the different parts of the UFO vehicles, but would talk to an engineer and explain things to him. But he was invisible. You didn't see him.
OK. Okay.
Now, I want to say something here, and I know this is hard for people to buy into, but there are a number of photographs which are available now, and you may have many of them, which show a fence in the program, in the picture. And there's light behind the fence, and you're looking over the fence. That's what the picture's doing, at mm-hmm. some person mm-hmm. or something. And you're going to see an extraterrestrial, in most cases, the gray types, but then the tall grays, too. And you're going to see them in different positions because the camera picks them up sometimes where you can't see them.
All right.
Okay?
Uh-huh.
Now, so those photographs, they can be taken any place in the United States. You don't realize that you have not just beautiful girls and good-looking men, extraterrestrials, in your shopping center, okay? Not just movie stars. They're all over your planet. So the Nordic types were visible. Some of these other types, you see somebody standing with another person. Now, this is the operative thing. He sees somebody standing in engineering with another person, except the other person isn't there. And he's talking to him.
Right.
And you'll see him go over and go around another person to the drafting board. And they'll look at the drafting board. The one guy will. But the extraterrestrial is looking at it, too. And so this is, I think, would maybe some sort of exception, the only type of physical extraterrestrials that they brought back of having seen.
So okay, but
they
were they...
They're seeing Nordic people,
mm-hmm.
and it's difficult in some cases even to know that, yes, those were Nordic fellows, men.
Okay.
But the grays, or the tall, or the tall grays, mm-hmm. middle height,
mm-hmm.
These would show up in photographs of people standing by even extraterrestrial vehicles out on the apron, where there's trucks around, there's personnel walking, there's men talking to even
yes.
some of the soldiers with the swastika on.
Yes.
There will be this odd-looking person sort of talking to somebody else that's not there. If you get a photograph of that,
uh-huh.
Some of those photographs that the Germans, that the operatives brought back, had pictures in them, but they're silhouettes. Like, sort of, not white, but gray color.
Mm-hmm.
And so there may have been others, but I personally didn't ever hear them say it.
So the grays were there, but they were essentially invisible. They were talking telepathically to a human, a technician, an engineer, whatever. And there are pictures of the engineers speaking to someone who doesn't always appear in the picture, but is there nonetheless. I got it.
And there are a lot of photographs today that are taken here in the United States
mm-hmm.
Of somebody's backyard. And there will be one of these fellows or two of them in the back. Sometimes there will be even three of them.
Mm-hmm.
And they will be not just standing there. They're going to have their arms up. And in some cases, they even put their arm above their eyes, trying to shade the light of maybe an automobile's lights at night, of facing them. And so it's quite remarkable for those to be taken here now. And then that having been taken place, because there were so many different extraterrestrial people helping the Third Reich. Crazy.
Yeah, that's a remarkable story. I want to also mention the operatives again, one more time. How many approximately were rotating in and out for the debriefing sessions? How many did you have in there? Now, I know there are different levels of espionage and spying during wars, but the ones you were working with were engaged in trying to discover, disclose, and present to you data on these extremely science fiction-like projects. How many? How many were there?
Well, originally he had 29, and then a number of them were had health problems and were unable to continue what they were doing. Two of them were, of course, taken out. But they themselves continued to go back. It's like they didn't get vacations. When they finished maybe a week or 2 weeks, that was it, and they go back. And so it's like almost a 24-hour thing, 7 days a week.
Uh-huh.
And so the number of people that were actually continuing to operate sort of slowed down by the fourth year.
Right.
And
right.
They did bring in two others, and mm-hmm. They did work. One of them actually did the whole last year. But you're talking to sort of like friends, and the admiral treated these fellows like his sons almost, and he would even use that expression. They would say, "Back off, son," and something like this, and then he was an extremely nice admiral. I would sort of like to talk about him a little bit later, too.
Okay. All right.
This was not the atmosphere in his little office. We had himself, the typist, at least one of the three captains, and myself on one side, and the ops on the other side in a small office. Up in the upper level of that tower over at North Island Naval Air Station, as you can see from San Diego, still there.
Yeah,
it's just unbelievable.
Okay,
unbelievable. He established the atmosphere.
Okay, stand by, Bill. We have to pause for a few minutes. Get yourself a drink of water. We'll come right back. Hold on.